This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by the Zona Plus, an effective non-drug treatment for high blood pressure. It's a safe, easy way to lower your blood pressure naturally, and it's so effective it works for 9 in 10 people. The Zona Plus is a high-tech smart device that guides you through a patented therapy that's personalized to your unique physiology. To find out more, go to tryzona.com or call toll-free 888-408-6141. As a listener to Intelligent Medicine, you can get $50 off and free shipping. Just use the coupon code Hoffman at checkout at tryzona.com. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and once again, it is time for our weekly Q&A with Layla. Layla Mudin is here with us today. She's our Hoffman Center nutritionist. We do a weekly duet answering your questions. Questions can come to us via radio program at AOL.com. That's the address for your emails containing questions related to Intelligent Medicine topics, nutrition, supplements, health-related issues, and we try to answer as many questions as we can during our Q&A with Layla each week. How you doing, Layla?
Okay, Dr. Hoffman, how are you?
Good, good. Well, here we are, summer, and in a new office, and with a new way of ordering supplements, and it's a lot of changes for us, but the good news is that people keep listening, and we hit a milestone, of course. Last week, we attained the milestone of 4 million podcasts. Yeah, that's amazing.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, so that means that 4 million times people have downloaded the Intelligent Medicine Podcast since its inception just a couple of years ago. So that's great news. People are listening.
That's great. Yeah. It makes it all that much more gratifying to be able to do this and for people to be able to listen. That's wonderful.
Exactly. And it kind of strengthens my resolve, and I'm sure yours, to provide people with information that is A, interesting, B, relevant, and C, accurate, you know, because we have a big responsibility. We have a big listenership. People, look, we know your time is valuable, and if you spend your time with us listening to this podcast, we, with renewed commitment, are going to provide you with what we believe is right in your wheelhouse in terms of providing you with value, subjects related to your health and well-being. So, and I'm sure you echo that sentiment, right?
Absolutely. Yes.
Okay. I'll start this podcast with a couple of epic fails in medicine that we recorded this week. There's concern that sometimes older individuals get medicines and treatments that are irrelevant, you know, such as the phenomenon of, the average 79-year-old woman reporting for an annual pap smear when all her previous pap smears have been normal, or people, getting repeated colonoscopies when there's no bowel problems and they're 85 and they just dutifully report for their colonoscopy every 3 to 5 years. There's actually, a lot in the medical literature now that attempts to debunk that. But here, two really often used therapies came up short in relationship to seniors this week. If you're a healthy senior, this study shows that statins won't protect you. The headline here, no statin primary prevention seen for seniors. And by the way, this comes to me from not from some alternative medical journal. It comes to me through Doximity, which is that's actually a medical news service for physicians. Mm-hmm. And what the article says is that for primary prevention, look, I mean, if you've had a stent, if you've had a bypass, if you have demonstrable heart disease, if you have a high calcium score on an EBT scan, which is a test I like to do to vet people to see if indeed they really need statins. This is something we do. The research shows that there is no survival benefit. Even if you may lower cholesterol, there's no survival benefit for patients over, let me check out the actual cutoff here, what they consider a senior. 65 years and older. Okay. This is a big, big trial. No benefit was found when a statin was given for primary prevention to older adults. Now, that may mean, like, typical scenario, an older individual who is 65 or, you know, 68 or 72 comes in, and their cholesterol is like 230. And that means that their their LDL, their bad cholesterol, may be 100 and, I don't know, let's pick a number, 136, depending on the HDL. They may have a pretty good HDL, but they've not had heart disease. They have no discernible plaque. No study reveals that they are have a plaque burden. They haven't had a heart attack, and they don't have angina. And they're given a statin. Quite routinely, very routinely. And there's probably, if not tens of millions, there's probably many millions of individuals who fit that category. They say in this study that no benefit was found when pravastatin, a common cholesterol-lowering drug, was given to for primary prevention to older adults with moderate hyperlipidemia and even hypertension. And you see, hypertension is a risk factor for cardiovascular disease, so they say, oh my goodness, you're hypertensive, you could have heart disease, give you a statin. Boom. No. And the cutoff here actually was among adults 75 years and older. Okay. So they really did not see any difference in the 65 to 74 cohort. But in particular, the 75 and up, no benefit whatsoever. So, you know, when is this going to be translated into practice by doctors? No, I think doctors are in kind of a CYA posture. They like to prescribe. They feel like
you're reading my mind.
Yeah.
The CYA posture. Absolutely.
Yeah. And, you know, they also feel like they're benefiting the patient. They really do. I mean, earnestly, they've been taught that this is the way to go. Second study. Okay. Along the same lines. They did a study on bisphosphonates. Okay, these are drugs that are used to prevent osteoporosis, most commonly Actonel, Beneva, and Fosamax. And then there's an intravenous one called Reclast. And this is something that, Layla, didn't we do a seminar on this about 3 or 4 years ago?
Yes.
Yeah, it was an emergency summit because we just discovered that there were downsides of the medications that we've come to rely upon to prevent osteoporosis, and we were going to provide natural alternatives. And so here we are 3 or 4 years later, headline, specific long-term therapy may not prevent fractures in older women. What they actually found is that women who took these drugs for 10 to 13 years, which is too long, they actually had higher fracture rates compared with women who took the medication for 2 years. So can you imagine? It's like less is more when it comes to these medications. And pretty soon after you start taking these medications, the downsides begin to outweigh the upsides.
Yes. And, you know, those women who are taking it for, you know, more than 5 years, we already know that the way that the mechanism of action of bisphosphonates is it kind of leaves you with old, brittle bone.
Yeah.
There's supposed to be bone turnover.
Yeah.
But these bisphosphonates are effectively slowing all that down and inhibiting new bone remodeling. And then they get those freaky fractures. I forget what they're called, Dr. Hoffman.
Called atypical fractures. It's like, you know, step off a curb. You know, I wasn't, you know, I didn't fall. There was barely any impact. And all of a sudden, I felt, you know, searing pain in my leg.
Right.
And
like,
you know, I fell down.
Strap hanging on the subway and the train jerked a little bit and I fractured my, my femur. Right. Yeah.
So, you know, I think rarely there's a place for these medications. I prescribe them very, very infrequently these days. But there's so many good natural ways. This is not the place to go into the natural approach to osteoporosis because we've done that many times before here. But and we probably will do it again. Let's take some questions. What have we got today?
Okay, we've got an email from Tony. Tony says, first, I love your show and have learned a lot from your podcasts.
Okay. We're going to be handing out honorary PhDs to our listeners.
Yeah.
After 3 years, you know, you'll all get certificates in the mail.
Right. Well, Dr. Hoffman, I have to say, with your clinical focus podcasts, that could be a reality. So Tony writes, after about 2 years ago, my physician included some genetic testing in my blood work, and I came up heterozygous for the COMT2 polymorphism. Mm-hmm. Well, then my physician told me that quercetin and T-catechins should be avoided. So this means I've stopped taking quercetin for my allergies, and I no longer take EGCG or drink green tea. My question is simply, am I doing the right thing avoiding them? Am I missing out on the benefits of these two very important nutrients? Yes.
So let me comment on this, is that we're talking here about genetics, and there's genetic testing that reveals what are called SNPs. And there are some people out there who are very wonky. I mean clinicians and doctors mm-hmm. of various mm-hmm. types who take these this genetic information and come up with very elaborate formulations about what supplements people should take and what supplements people should not take. And there is some truth to this, but I think that it is far from settled science, such considerations as whether you should take quercetin or green tea if you have the COMT variant of a genetic code. Now, what COMT is, it's an interesting gene. It's actually sometimes been dubbed the warrior versus worrier gene.
Yes.
Which is interesting because it has to do with catecholamines. Now, catecholamines include dopamine and epinephrine and norepinephrine, and another word for norepinephrine is adrenaline. And if you have too much adrenaline, roughly speaking, you could be a worrier, all right? And COMT is the gene that degrades those catecholamines. It's actually mm-hmm. something that helps them be metabolized. Okay, so follow me. This gets a little complicated. If the gene is weak, then you will overproduce catecholamines. So you will be in a state of catecholamine overload. And that may be good because actually catecholamines are the feel-good hormones or neurotransmitters. But they're also associated with worry and anxiety. Okay. Mm-hmm. So we mm-hmm. don't even know, one individual may have that gene and be a worrier and another individual may not be. It varies. The expression of genes is governed by a lot of different factors within the body and governed by interactions with other genes and nutrients and environment and experience and, upbringing and all these kind of stuff. So on the other hand, the warrior gene, the warrior may be free of these genes, but maybe more prone to addiction because they are kind of like dopamine junkies. They're
out looking for dopamine. Yes,
They're hungry for dopamine because they underproduce it, or they degrade it too quickly. So that's the theory. Now I tested myself, and I'm heterozygous, and I feel like I'm sort of a worried warrior.
A cautious warrior, Dr. Hoffman.
Yeah, but
you're a cautious warrior. That's a good thing.
Yeah, it's a good thing. So there's it's a mixed type. And that's what this person is. That's what this person is. And in fact, I did look this up, in preparation to answer this question. And there is some evidence that if you are COMT double hit for the gene that degrades dopamine and the other catecholamines, that you may want to refrain from quercetin or EGCG. But this is only speculative, and it only applies to people who have the double hit, and this person only has a single hit. They're heterozygous. And so, we're going way too far down the line of minute, obsessive, compulsive slicing and dicing of genetic information. I really feel that this is a form of, in some ways, modern day phrenology. They used to do, they used to have the science of like the different, indentations and depressions of your skull. And it used to yield all this information about your intellect and your personality. And I just think that this ain't yet ready for prime time.
Right. And their approach, I feel, is they're looking at these particular SNPs in a vacuum.
Yeah.
not in that person's unique biochemistry, which also has to do with what kind of medical conditions or medications are they also on, and so forth and so on. So it's, human beings are not automatons. It's not as simple as looking at a particular mechanism. That mechanism changes depending on what else is happening.
I mean, for example, they just came up with this amazing research that I think found 58 different gene loci for intelligence. Okay. Hmm. So, you know, there's like, do you have the smart gene or you don't? No, it's not that simple. There are 58. And oh, by the way, at the end of the article, they said, and these are just some of them. You know, it's like landmark research that they found 58 genes, but they realize that there are other, many, many other genes that they've, are yet to be discovered that, that have an impact on intelligence. Mm-hmm. And so, if you can imagine, you know, 58 times, 10,000 possibilities, do the math on that. You'd need a supercomputer of enormous power. Maybe you'd have to link all the supercomputers in the world together, and you barely would be able to get the proper computation of, you know, is this person with a certain genetic array going to be smart or dumb? You know, it's not yet ready for prime time. Although this is an emerging science, and I think it's great because it's going to give us insight into which nutrients we may need more of. It may give us insight into which medications people are more likely to respond to, or if they're sensitive to medications. We're already seeing some advances, but this science is in its infancy, and it really has a long way to go.
Yeah, I agree. So our advice to Tony, gee, I don't think I'd stop taking quercetin and drinking green tea, especially if it's helping your allergies and you feel fine, Tony. I think at the end of the day, it's how are you feeling?
And by the way, quercetin is marvelous for allergies because according to certain studies, it outperforms cromolyn, which is a potent allergy anti-allergy agent. Especially in the gastrointestinal tract. So when we see patients who have histamine intolerance or mast cell activation syndrome, we give them a lot of quercetin. I just saw a patient the other day, and I gave her, I think, three quercetins three times a day, along with some medication to quell her allergic symptoms.
Wow. Quercetin is also very good for those taking niacin for their lipid profile, to improve their lipid profile, and they have flushing reactions.
Yeah.
Taking quercetin 30 minutes before taking niacin can help to quell that the flush.
Yeah, and for the same reasons, because it actually helps to calm the mast cells so that they don't release a lot of inflammatory and histamine-like substances.
Yeah. We're seeing a lot more people with high histamine lately.
Yeah.
Which is really, really interesting. So quercetin really has its place. Yeah.
Yeah. And by the way, an excellent podcast that I did recently with Dr. Dempsey, Tanya Dempsey, on that subject. Mm-hmm. She is really brilliantly analyzed the data out there on what she terms mast cell activation syndrome. And she turned me on to a book by a Dr. Afrin, which really lays the groundwork for that theory. I don't recommend that book for lay people because it's highly theoretical, but for health professionals out there who are listening to this podcast who want more insight into mast cell activation syndrome, MCAS, listen to the podcast. Mm-hmm. We did it a week or so ago. And also you can follow up for more detailed understanding of this phenomenon by reading Dr. Afrin's book. It's very technical, and I really think you need to be medically trained to get through it. But, you know, if you're a wonky and enlightened person, you might take a crack at it.
There you go. Okay, Tony, thank you for your email. All right. Very interesting question here from Judy. Hi, Layla and Dr. Hoffman. I remember Dr. Hoffman mentioning staying away from pasta if you have allergies. What is the difference if I had fresh pasta as opposed to box pasta? Does one have more gluten? And if I was gluten intolerant or if I had hay fever? Also, my daughter had an episode of having a pasta dish at a restaurant, and the next morning she was dizzy. Could that be related?
Well, you want to tackle it?
Grains like gluten, these are related to grasses. This has to do with hay fever. For those who have hay fever, allergies to pollen of grass particularly, they may do much better being on a grain-free diet at the very least.
This is the so-called cross-reactivity where, you know, it's like, I asked some people, do you eat trees? And they go, no. Mm. And I go, no, you do. Do you ever have an apple? Do you have a plum or a pear? Cherries? You're eating a tree. And if you have tree pollen allergies, well, maybe that could make it worse. And similarly, when we talk about grass allergy, the grains are in the grass family. So there is some cross-reactivity. So that makes some sense.
Right. Plus,
some people without grass allergies, gluten just turns on their whole immune system and makes them more allergic.
That's true. That's true.
Lights up the immune system.
Yeah. Gluten can also cause leaky gut.
Yes.
As well, when we have leaky gut, we're allergic, among other things.
Yes.
And that also prompts autoimmunity. It's kind of like a vicious circle that gets started.
Or it may change the flora in the gut in some way. It may promote candida growth or the growth of certain bacteria that are a favorable milieu for allergic problems. I mean, there are a variety of mechanisms by which it can make things worse. And just the sheer carbohydrate load. You know, some people do better on a low-carbohydrate diet when they're allergic, moving more towards a paleo or ketogenic diet, merely just restricting their carbohydrate intake. So, you know, the starch is, for our listeners, a little basic science, you know, glucose is a single molecule of sugar. Well, starch is like a necklace of glucoses, and all it has to do is be broken down in your gut by the digestive process, and then you release a lot of sugar into your system.
Yeah. The sugar necklace we call starch.
Yes.
I like that.
Yeah.
Very interesting. And, you know, Judy, it doesn't really make a difference whether the pasta is coming out of a box or if it's fresh. If anything, if you're going to continue to eat pasta, I would urge you to cook it al dente. This can help slow the absorption of that big carbohydrate load. So that might be something. But,
it becomes more resistant. Is that that?
Yes. It becomes more resistant. It's going to break down more slowly. But still, you know, fresh gluten or box gluten, it doesn't really matter. It's still gluten.
Mm-hmm.
So, and anybody who's even slightly gluten sensitive, and many people don't know that they are. But, you know, what it really comes down to, and I have to quote Dr. Peter Green on this in his book about celiac disease, is that the bottom line is gluten is a 33 amino acid peptide that the human gut has trouble breaking down.
Mm-hmm.
And this itself is a problem.
Yes. Yeah.
Itself is a problem. So
here's an alternative. And, you know, for connoisseurs of pasta, they're going to say, no, this ain't the same. It's, you know, it's the taste and texture are different. But I've been exploring something completely different. It's shirataki noodles. And have you ever had shirataki noodles, Layla? I have not.
No, I've had zoodles, which is zucchini noodles.
Oh, okay. Yeah, which you can get at the supermarket. You know, now they actually pre-cut them so that you don't have to have
We've got that spiralizer thing.
Oh, you have a spiralizer. Yeah, well, that's...
Right. That's my husband's favorite toy lately, so...
How's that working out for you? It does the job?
It does the job. Zucchini spaghetti is great. Anyway, tell me about your product.
Yeah. Well, just a comment on the spiralizer. You can get these handheld ones, you know, for $26 or something, and there's maybe a lot of work involved and maybe not so precise. Or you can literally spend a lot of money for these mechanical spiralizers that, you know, they'll spiralize a piece of quartz. You know, you could put it in there, and they're so powerful. various vegetables, zucchini, and so on and so on. Anyway, shirataki is made from konjac yam, which is elephant yam, And this ends up being composed largely of water and glucomannan, which is a dietary fiber. And you're getting very little in the way of calories and very little in the way of digestible carbohydrates. And really, it's kind of a neutral flavor. It's more of a texture. So it will take on the flavor and texture of what you put on it, whether it's tomato sauce or whether it's, you know, your favorite sauce for pasta or for, you know, Japanese noodles, or you can season it with whatever.
It's almost like taking Welbedex, PGX.
Yes, and it's a really good prebiotic, and but it involves a little preparation. You have to rinse it, and you have to you boil it for just a couple of minutes, and then you put it in a pan and you dry them out a little bit, because otherwise they're too moist. But they're made from konjac yam. And they're called shirataki noodles, and, you know, I get them from Thrive Market, but you can probably track them down at, you know, big, reliable health food stores. Give it a shot.
Yeah.
See if you like them.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's an alternative, and it's great for dieters or people who want to be on a low carb diet, because it's reminiscent of pasta, but it doesn't deliver the caloric or carbohydrate hit, has a good effect on the gastrointestinal balance. Okay.
Yeah.
We need to pause and give us a preview of what we're going to do in part two.
Ah, gadolinium toxicity.
Whoa.
Masquerading as autoimmune disease.
Another peril. Let's identify it and describe it in part two. Stay with us. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoppen. And today with Hoppen Center nutritionist Layla Mutin, it's our weekly Q&A with Layla on intelligent medicine.